Hi everyone. I'm still hard at work preparing for the next season of Asian Americana, which will come out later this year. But in the meantime, I wanted to share another great podcast covering Asian American stories, especially before Asian Pacific American Heritage Month is over. Mid-Pacific is a podcast from Capital Public Radio that explores what it means to be Asian American and the feeling of being caught between two worlds. Host Sarah Mises Tan brings you stories of food, politics, family, and more, and shows how these experiences influence our ideas of identity. Today, you'll hear one of their episodes, Changing Places, New Spaces. After the music, I'll hand you over to Sarah. I'll be right back after the story to chat with Sarah, so stick around. Till then, I'm Quincy Surasmith, and this is Asian Americana. We're still here.
But now here we are where I want to formally start the tour, so I want you all to look behind me.
I'm standing in one of the oldest Chinatowns in California, and even the country, San Francisco Chinatown. And looking up under the historic entryway, with its green tile awnings and red lanterns, I decide to take a guided tour, hoping to learn more about this place's history and its importance for Asian Americans.
So first of all, good morning everybody. My name is Linda Lee, and I am the owner of All About Chinatown Tours.
Linda's tour leads us through the famous narrow alleys of Chinatown. We visit some open-air markets, a Buddhist temple, and a fortune cookie factory.
Did you like it, the samples?
Yeah.
So fresh, right? So here's the story behind the fortune cookie. Do you know this? Who invented it?
I expected I might feel a sense of pride in going on this tour. In a lot of ways, it's a place that represents the beginning of Asian American identity in this country. But I actually ended up feeling disconnected from the entire experience and was left with that distinct feeling of being caught in the middle. As Chinatowns gentrify or disappear or just change in terms of who's living there, these spaces can be somewhat ephemeral. Over time, many of these places won't continue to serve the same people that they do today. So I asked myself, what do these neighborhoods mean to Asian Americans, and how important are they to building our present sense of identity? You're listening to Mid-Pacific, a podcast exploring Asian American identity. I'm your host, Sarah Mises Tan. So I took the Chinatown walking tour, but I got the sense that it wasn't for someone like me, someone who was neither a newly immigrated Chinese person nor an American with no familiarity with Chinese culture. I did meet up with someone who helped me better connect with Chinatown's roots, though.
My name is Mei Shonik. We're standing here in Portman Square. This is the living room of Chinatown.
Mei is a third-generation Chinese-American.
Oh, well, I'm just a typical Chinese that was born and raised here in San Francisco and lived in Chinatown. When I was growing up, the library was my refuge and a place where I can imagine what life was.
May's grandfather immigrated to the city in 1905 and worked on nearby farms and sold vegetables in the area. She remembers growing up in Chinatown in the 1960s and 70s and loved the close-knit community.
It's like going back to my roots. And I could walk down the streets and I can say so-and-so's father used to own that. So I have a lot of association where I don't just look at what is there right now. I have the memories.
But May also says that San Francisco Chinatown isn't quite the same community it was when she was growing up. Many of the families she knew have since sold their businesses and moved out to the suburbs. And most of the folks who live in this area now are elderly and live in low-income housing.
The children don't want to keep up the restaurant because it's too much work. So this building is just kind of open and was left for a sale. The whole thing is that, okay, it could go to the highest bidder. That means that person can come here and just completely tear it up and make it into what they want.
What she's talking about, that's part of how gentrification and displacement happen. And that's what we're seeing all over the country. But at the same time, she also knows change in Chinatown is unstoppable.
This is a historical landmark that is continuing to evolve. So there may be changes, but new people come in and then new people bring in different styles.
In New York's Chinatown, street signs written in Chinese characters are now being removed or taken down as its Chinese population dwindles. Younger generations are moving out for better opportunities, and older generations are being pushed out by rising rents. In Chicago and Boston, new high-rise apartments are being built in historic Chinatowns, and many are concerned about how this could price out older residents. In some ways, it feels like San Francisco Chinatown today, a lot of it just isn't really for Asian Americans. That's why I connected with Andrew Leong, a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's been working on a documentary about how Chinatowns across the country are evolving and gentrifying.
We find a sense of belonging and security in this particular place. It is sanctuary for us. And that's why, you know, we gravitate and we want to make sure that, you know, Chinatowns exist, not just for the Chinese, really, but for all Asian Americans, you know, into the next generations.
So Asian Americans have always been cast as the perpetual foreigner, someone who will never really be seen as American. And Andrew says because of this, Asian Americans will always need these specific neighborhoods that cater directly to us.
For those Asian Americans that don't, quote unquote, need it, I think in some measure they're kidding themselves. Because as Asian Americans, you know, we are caught in that particular space about belonging.
He also says that one of the challenges for Asian immigrants is they often seek out whiteness in where they live because they associate whiteness with prosperity. So they eventually want to leave these historic enclaves. Chinatown is where these families initially land, but that's not the goal to continue to live there.
They then gravitate towards, you know, what is white identity, whatever is the dominant, you know, identity within that new geographical locale that they live in.
But because Asian Americans aren't white, and we have never really been accepted as such, they lose their sense of community belonging when they move to a more prosperous white majority neighborhood.
And so you develop as the young person growing up, you know, you have that split identity, you have that struggle with that identity.
He says his family originally lived in Chicago's Chinatown, but soon they moved out to the majority white suburbs of Iowa. And he had a bit of an identity crisis. He wasn't white, but he was surrounded by white culture, which saw him as an outsider. I'm sure many of you can relate to this feeling. He became embarrassed about being Asian.
It slowly ingrains itself into your psyche about how proud you are to be the identity that you originated from, and you're then, you know, melting yourself into whiteness.
Andrew says we lose our collective sense of Asian American identity when places like San Francisco's Chinatown gentrify or are redeveloped. When Asian Americans move out to the white suburbs, they feel a pressure to become white, which is an unachievable goal. But let's think about this for a second. What happens when Asian Americans move out to the suburbs and those suburbs are not majority white, but in fact, majority Asian? Is something of the old Chinatowns preserved? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I want to share something we heard briefly in our first episode.
My name is Ryan Liu. So I generally identify with being Cantonese, but I also identify with being an Angeleno, being a native of LA, being a native Californian, and, you know, sometimes depending on the news of the day, yes, I'm an American too.
Ryan grew up and lives in the San Gabriel Valley, a collection of cities about a half hour east of downtown Los Angeles. I spoke with Ryan before the tragic shooting that happened over Lunar New Year that killed 12 people in Monterey Park. Ryan believes that this area is actually the seat of modern Asian America in California. These are the new Chinatowns.
Yeah, I think what makes this place special, and I think a lot of other diaspora communities can relate to this, is that when I'm in this area, you know, I don't really have to change who I am, and that this place sort of, it represents me, and I feel like a good representative of the area.
Ryan's family actually originally lived in Los Angeles Chinatown. But once they became more financially stable, they moved out to the San Gabriel Valley like many other upwardly mobile Asian Americans. Monterey Park, a neighborhood of the San Gabriel Valley, was actually specifically marketed as a suburban community for Asian Americans in the 1960s and 70s. And today, the San Gabriel Valley is majority Asian. Over 500,000 Asian Americans live there, according to the most recent census, with the largest groups being of Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Filipino, Taiwanese, and Vietnamese descent.
I suspect that if had I grown up in an area where there were very few people who looked like me, I think there would be more of a, you know, a bit of an identity crisis or more of a concerted effort to know who you are and how you fit into the community.
It kind of seems ideal in some ways. But I also know many Asian Americans aren't so lucky to have grown up there.
And I think when you grow up in the Sangre Valley, it's such a privilege to not have to necessarily go through those experiences. Like, I think that it's different in the Sangre Valley. It allows the people who grew up here to be more natural and practice whatever culture they come from in whatever way they want.
But for all that sense of belonging and identity that comes from this place, Ryan also says he doesn't think suburban or modern Asian American enclaves could ever replace urban Chinatowns. In part because he says his family needed Los Angeles Chinatown to establish their foothold before they could move to a place like the San Gabriel Valley.
What I see Chinatowns across the U.S. nowadays is that for the most part, a lot of them house like lower income seniors. Their primary purpose, at least today, is that they provide a specifically dense neighborhood with public transportation and walkability and services for a specific type of demographic that, you know, often may not have family support or resources to get around and live their lives. And I think that is not being fulfilled in the suburban Chinatowns or San Gabriel Valley, really.
Maybe older Chinatowns don't hold relevance for younger Asian Americans anymore. But there are newer groups of Asian immigrants making urban spaces a place of belonging. This connection between old and new really stands out in Long Beach, less than an hour south of LA's downtown Chinatown, where Cambodian immigrants and Cambodian Americans are finding a renewed sense of identity that they thought they'd lost. Our associate producer, Jaira Deng, visited recently. Jaira, hey, what's going on?
Hey, Sarah, thanks for having me.
So you visited Cambodia Town in Long Beach. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So a lot of people actually don't know this, but Long Beach actually has the largest number of Cambodians living outside of Cambodia. And there's a thriving community here that's been built in the past three decades. The first place that I visited was Sophie's Cambodia Town Food and Music.
My name's Sophie Kud. I'm 55 years old. When I arrived in the United States, I was 9 years old, so I didn't have a chance to learn much back home. I was, you know, a little kid trying to just survive. I didn't have a chance to learn much, but being in Long Beach, I had a lot of opportunity to learn quite a bit about my culture.
And what drew Sophie particularly to Long Beach out of all places?
She was drawn to this area by the recommendation of like her friends who knew that she had a Cambodian restaurant business. And people were telling her, hey, there's a lot of Cambodians that live in Long Beach. Like, you should move your business here.
How do you feel that Cambodia Town and its existence has shaped younger generations' view and vision of what it means to be Cambodian and Cambodian American?
Yeah, so I talked to Johnny Chum, who's a native of Long Beach and also a restaurant owner.
And I own a drink company called Sweetgrass Sugarcane Juice. I am Cambodian American. I am the son of refugees. Here we are, the diaspora that's living in Long Beach, California.
And he remembers growing up feeling disconnected from parts of his Cambodian American identity.
For a little while, I don't think anybody really had any identity when it comes to being Cambodian American. There's a disconnect of like, you know, I'm an American. I didn't escape the genocide. My parents did. And so, like, there's so much unspoken trauma between that and the fact that I speak English and it's really difficult to really, like, communicate with our parents.
And Johnny sort of describes how he's seen the community kind of rally together because of the designation Cambodia Town and sort of, like, noticing how people are gathering and organizing around their culture and their community's needs.
I'm starting to believe in the idea of abundance and there's enough to go around for everybody. And I'm hoping that shift is going to be the same with everybody else. And so once we come together, we're going to be a force.
I feel like a lot of us Asian Americans can totally relate, or at least us first generation Asian Americans can totally relate to that funny feeling of feeling in that gap between like your culture and your family's heritage on one end, and then also trying to assimilate into, you know, the culture that's surrounding you right now, American culture.
Yeah, and I think that's even almost exacerbated by the fact that so many Cambodians came to the U.S. as refugees, and there's a lot of trauma and a lot of mistrust. You know, I heard a lot of people that I talked to describe sort of like this, the regime that had been in place in Cambodia at the time was really like created a lot of distrust between your neighbors because people would be reporting on each other. And then so when you come to a new country and you're trying to start fresh, how do you like build those connections between you and your community again? It's about rebuilding trust and also trying to find a community in a foreign space.
As an Asian American yourself, Jaira, what did it feel like to you to be in Cambodia Town? Did you end up feeling like, you know, we heard from our expert earlier that all these Asian enclaves across America tend to hold a sense of belonging for Asian Americans?
So as someone who's Taiwanese and Hong Kong American, I still felt a lot of like draw to these cultural places because it just felt really similar to like how I felt growing up, which is these intergenerational connections and also just like the connection and communal gathering around food. Like these are threads that I think a lot of Asian Americans experience navigating between that liminal space of being both American and from somewhere else. Cambodia Town is like the only place in Long Beach that I feel like really connected to this like Central Asian American community where I'm not just Asian or I'm not just American, but I can be both at the same time.
I find myself asking, if we're Asian American, where is Asian America? And I think the answer is wherever we are. Even if that space and those people are constantly changing and evolving. I think about what Johnny Chom said, this idea about coming together in Cambodia Town, and how when we come together, we can be a force. And that's exactly where we're headed. Stick with us for our next episode, where we'll talk about the power of coming together and what it means to organize and be in politics in spaces that aren't explicitly for Asian Americans. Mid-Pacific is a CAP Radio production, reported and hosted by me, Sarah Mises-Tan. Our producer is Jen Picard. Associate producer is Jaira Deng. Antonio Munez mixed the sound. We had editing help from Nick Miller and Shane Nuesca. Sally Schilling is our executive producer. Special thanks to Alyssa Jong-Perry. Chris Bruno is in charge of marketing. Our designs were created by Marissa Espiritu. Renee Thompson is our digital products manager. Our theme song is Can't Hold Us Back by Polar Tropica. You can find that on iTunes or Spotify. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, be sure to subscribe, follow, or add us to your podcast feed. Thank you so much for listening to Mid-Pacific.
That was Changing Places, New Spaces from the podcast Mid-Pacific. You can find out more about Mid-Pacific at capradio.org/midpacific. Again, that's capradio.org/MIDPacific. I recently called Sarah to ask her more about the show.
My name is Sarah Mises-Tan. I use she, her pronouns. I am the host of Mid-Pacific. It's a new podcast exploring Asian American identity on CAP Radio. That's Sacramento's NPR news station. And I am also the race and equity reporter there.
Thinking about her own complex identity led Sarah to want to create a show like Mid-Pacific.
A little bit of like personal background is that I'm not like one type of Asian person. My parents come from two different places on the Asian continent, and they are from two kind of different immigration patterns as well. I've grown up identifying with the word Asian American, maybe just for lack of a better word for being able to describe myself in one concise term. Like I'm not Chinese American and I'm not Korean American. I'm Chinese and Korean American. Yeah, so Asian American is a term that I've used for what feels like a very long time. But at the same time, like when I actually think about the word, I am not totally sure what it means or what it encompasses.
And in the past few years, Sarah thought about how many other people were rethinking their relationship to being Asian American and what that meant.
And then I think the real catalyst for things was first the George Floyd demonstrations, which I think had a lot of people who identify as Asian American or who are grouped as Asian American kind of questioning where they stood in terms of that discussion, which could end up being very black and white and very binary. And then I think it intensified even more with the attacks on Asian Americans the following year. And just, you know, the term Asian American suddenly like just became something that I started to notice being thrown around a whole lot more. So I think that question started to really surface because I think in all of those things that were happening, Asian Americans were asking like, wait, am I this? Like, am I that? Like, I'm being grouped with this group of people, but I don't really identify that way. And, you know, I wanted to make a podcast that basically explored like, what does this term Asian American mean? It's something that's thrown around quite a lot.
So Sarah wanted to explore those ideas with Mid-Pacific, but she knew she wasn't the first to do so.
And I know that there are many, many Asian American podcasts, and I'm sure that someone has delved into these before. But I kind of wanted to be able to do my own deep dive and maybe what Mid-Pacific can offer that other podcasts don't is that it's my perspective.
Mid-Pacific doesn't just focus on Sarah's perspective, but also the conversations that ensue.
What I really wanted Mid-Pacific to be was just something that might feel like a little bit of like a conversation with friends. You know, I do want the discussion. Like, I think a lot of the topics that we delve into are conversations that I've had with friends and family members, and that people were kind of just saying, like, we do wish that there was an outlet for this. It's just sometimes it's really hard to get Asian Americans to talk about what defines Asian America for them. Yeah, I am kind of trying to figure out, like, what are some of those unifying factors of Asian America? I have a central belief that there are some things that unify all Asian Americans. Obviously, we're not a monolith, but I do think that there are some points of connection that we all have. And, you know, I kind of wanted to explore, like, what are some common markers of Asian American culture? That's what I want to look at in Mid-Pacific.
I asked Sarah what considerations she had while working on the episode you heard today.
I wanted to be careful of not falling into tropes about Chinatowns. They can be a loaded place for some people. I think in some ways they can be the originator of a lot of negative stereotypes about what it means to be Asian in this country. They are also places that can be places of exclusion, right? They were places that Asian Americans were forced to settle in as a result of not being able to settle elsewhere in a city. But I really wanted to avoid making it this like othering sort of place. I guess I wanted to like look at Chinatowns in a way that they are inclusive and in a way that they do connect with Asian Americans in an internal way and not in a way that kind of makes us as Asian Americans like cringe and pull away and say like, oh, we're not that. We're not that, you know?
I was also curious how they came to pick the specific neighborhoods they did for the episode.
Well, I wanted to pick the oldest and most historic Chinatown or arguably one of the oldest and most historic Chinatowns in the country as a starting place, since I think there are a lot of stereotypical tropes that come out of these like very old established Chinatowns. And so that's why I chose San Francisco Chinatown. It just seems like a natural starting place. It does feel like one of the very like the grandfathers of Chinatowns in this country. And then I wanted to choose the San Gabriel Valley just because I think it came up in a very different way than Chinatown did. The San Gabriel Valley was a place that was marketed specifically towards upwardly mobile Asian Americans. And that, to me, is a very different kind of catalyst for creating a space of belonging for Asian Americans. Like, in the end, I do think that there are overlaps in what San Francisco Chinatown did for its earliest immigrants and what the San Gabriel Valley did for its inhabitants as well. But they came up in two almost like opposite sorts of way. Like, one is very exclusionary. The other is like specifically, it kind of is inclusionary, like creating its own community in a way. So that's why I chose those two, because they seemed like two ends of a spectrum. And then I chose Long Beach just because it is a newer community. It is a different immigration pattern. It's a group of people who are coming from a very different place of even, you know, I guess we have them talk about it a little bit in this episode, but Cambodian American identity is, you know, it's being defined currently. It seems like we have San Francisco Chinatown on one end of the spectrum, the San Gabriel Valley on the other, and then we have Cambodia Town kind of like trying to figure out what direction it's going to go in the middle.
I actually live in the San Gabriel Valley now, though I grew up closer to Long Beach, and we got to chatting about some of the nuances of how we think about these communities.
I actually live in the San Gabriel Valley now, and something that I feel like is kind of painted in the episode is like, the idea that Asian Americanness is considered norm here, like this is just all the things you do, you get boba/bubble tea here, and you, you know, hang out and you go to school with a bunch of other Asian Americans, and you know, you walk around and it's a bunch of other Asian Americans. But something I think about, because in the past 10-15 years, a lot of media has come out covering San Gabriel Valley, especially in the YouTube space and like internet media in general, and it paints San Gabriel Valley as like not just where Asian Americanness is the norm, but as the ideal of Asian American norm. Like, what is a normal for Asian America? And something I think about a lot is like, it's really great here in many ways, but this place isn't every Asian American's normal. And I think you do touch upon that in the episode, but it's something I just want to emphasize all the time. Like, a lot of people who grew up here and have the benefit of growing up where they feel like they belong, and that's wonderful, but not everyone feels that same thing. And just because someone's experience isn't like the San Gabriel Valley one doesn't make it any less Asian American, you know?
Oh, totally. Yes, yes. I 100% agree as someone who did not grow up in the San Gabriel Valley. It was interesting to speak with Ryan Liu, who is a resident of the San Gabriel Valley and grew up there. And he kind of mentioned that he didn't have this like identity crisis that I think a lot of Asian Americans who are more like folks who did not grow up there tend to have. You know, I think a big part of the Asian American experience sometimes can be just asking yourself, like, where do I belong? Like, I don't really feel like I fit in here. This community doesn't really feel like home to me. People are not accepting of, you know, who I am. I think that is a huge part of the Asian American experience. And yeah, it would be inaccurate to say that if you're from the San Gabriel Valley, that is like the most pure form of Asian America.
So you mentioned that, like, a lot of folks felt like invited to this spaces, but not that long ago, and even during the time that people have been here, there's been stories about like the cities have flirted with making English only signage laws. And what's funny is that I actually did a short oral history of Monterey Park for my old job at KPCC, now LAist. And there was a time when Monterey Park was designed to be a place actually free of immigrant communities. Like, it was established by a lot of landowners to actually be like, we just want this to be a white neighborhood. You know, this is like hard redlining, right? Like, people can't live here. And so it's kind of neat in a way that Asian Americans have kind of filled a lot of these spaces anyway. But it's not to say that it was always idyllic.
I think that Ryan Liu kind of gets into this in saying, you know, that the San Gabriel Valley is not necessarily a place that's very welcoming or very even livable for people who are newer Asian immigrants or people who are of a certain economic strata. And that's really going to be cutting out a huge portion of the Asian American population. So yeah, I think super important to note these things.
San Gabriel Valley also used to have a lot of refugee Southeast Asian Americans, a lot of Chinese Cambodians, a lot of Chinese Vietnamese. And the area used to be heavily Cantonese, for example. And that's been changing a lot too. Like, as these communities, right, they don't live in stasis. These places change a lot. In historic Chinatowns, there are people who come in and are also refugee Chinese. Like, in Los Angeles Chinatown, a lot of the folks who live there aren't the legacy Chinese Americans that moved there, you know, decades and decades and centuries ago, right? A lot of them are folks who also came in the same wave as the folks that came to Long Beach in the Cambodian communities in the 80s and 90s. And it wasn't like, oh, Chinatown was this gleaming beacon of light on a hill. It was just like, that's where I think I can go live because it's cheap and I don't know where else to go. And same thing with like San Gabriel Valley. A lot of these communities shift over time. And so now there's a lot of Chinese immigration from mainland China. And that changes what languages are spoken here, because you used to have a lot of other Chinese languages spoken here. And now it's heavily Mandarin. A lot of these other communities end up having to move to other places, and it's fine that they're moving here. You know, like, I think it's interesting that they see this as a place that, like, oh, where I can feel at home, where I can feel belonging, where I can feel like I can make a life for myself. But it's just an important thing to remember that these places aren't in stasis. Like, they change with the people who live there.
Yes, I think that's kind of the beauty of these places. And, you know, we definitely touch on this in episode 2, just the shifting nature of Chinatown. But yeah, we kind of want it to be one thing in our minds, and it's just not. And I kind of love that.
I asked what other communities Sarah wishes she had room to include in this episode.
I feel like we could have had maybe a whole series, a sub-series of Mid-Pacific just on these towns. You know, someone pointed out that there are a lot of historic South Asian communities in the Bay Area. Like, looking at those South Asian communities, I think would have been fascinating. And, you know, the evolution of those communities and what's going on there, especially in, like, the kind of northern Central Valley area. A lot of them have come to farm in this zone here, kind of north of Sacramento. I really would love to have dove into those communities, like right around Yuba City and stuff. There's a Sikh community there that's been there for a very long time. We didn't get a chance to touch on those at all. And I think that maybe looking at places like Japan towns would have been interesting to me, just because those places seem to be like the places of greatest gentrification in some ways. Like, this could maybe just be from my experience of Japantowns in California, but like thinking of San Francisco Japantown, Los Angeles maybe is in like a slightly different place, but certainly San Francisco Japantown, it feels very touristified, like even more so than San Francisco Chinatown in a way.
LA's Little Tokyo is a place where it's kind of both factors, right? And it's also a great study case of like different neighborhoods get shaped different ways based on what institutions they have. And Little Tokyo, Los Angeles has a lot of local community organizations that each have their own interests and things they want out of the community. But because there's so many of those, they do influence and shape how the neighborhood develops or potentially gets gentrified or gets protected and whatever, right? And in a different way that, like, say, LA Chinatown, and that affects the shifts, you know, in those communities. I actually did not grow up in San Gabriel Valley. I grew up in the southeast part of LA County, which was also heavily Asian American, in a town called Cerritos. And next to Cerritos is Artesia, which is another kind of quote unquote little India. It's a big South Asian community there. I think about Edison, New Jersey as being another huge, huge, huge South Asian community. There's historic ones. I talked about it in a previous episode, like Little Manila in Stockton, California. And then even think about like what happens when your town becomes the cool part, like Koreatown in Los Angeles. Definitely started as an urban, like, Korean-American community where it was just, like, people had shops and services and just trying to make it. And now it's, like, associated with both LA's, like, nightlife culture of going to, like, bars and cool restaurants and cool places to listen to music and eat food and stuff. And also, like, the growing cultural influence of Korean culture from Korea and also Korean investment in that community is also shaping it. So there's like so many different kinds of stories I feel like are related to what we think of these quote-unquote ethnic towns, you know? Sarah shared a couple of other interesting stories from this season of Mid-Pacific.
I am maybe most excited about a couple of our last conversations, or the conversations that we've had in the second half of this season, where we did dive into tougher conversations about, you know, cross-racial solidarity. Is it possible? Like, is it a reasonable thing to expect with looking at the legacy of the LA riots and kind of how they bring us up to present day today and like what lessons we can learn from there? I think that conversation and just the nuance in it, I am really, really grateful for some of the folks that I was able to interview who were really able to like hit that nail on the head, because it's a tricky, complex topic. Talking especially about Asian and Black solidarity is very, very hairy. And so I am grateful for the people who did come forward to speak with me in really thoughtful and nuanced ways and kind of just like bring forward their perspectives and do so in a way that didn't other the other group or didn't malign the other group. And I was really excited about our last episode, which just dives into mental health and looking at the Asian mother-daughter relationship in particular. But I think it's just a larger conversation about generational expectations and the acculturation gap and just kind of bridging two cultures, which I think a lot of Asian Americans are familiar with.
I asked Sarah what kind of Asian American stories she connects with.
Stories that have identity and kind of questions around identity as the central tenet are ones that hook me. So people who turn around and are like, yeah, I'm not like 100% sure, actually. Like, am I this? Am I that? And however that comes out, whether it's in like the food that they cook or the dishes they create, the art that they make. But I think anybody with a story that's kind of like got a nuance about identity, some crossover in identity, a question about identity, those are the stories that really hook me.
We spoke a bit about how those questions about being Asian American play out in our own family.
Even my family has like a complicated definition of like how they identify. My grandfather is very proud of being American, But similarly, I feel like if you were to ask him directly, like how he identifies, he would tell you that he was Korean. Like he's very involved in the Korean American community, like teaching new Korean immigrants English, all that sort of thing. So it's tricky. And like even if you were to ask my mother, she identifies as being from Korea. And I don't think that she identifies with the term Asian American. Or at least maybe not in the same way that we talk about in Mid-Pacific. I don't know.
And, you know, something I think we've explored in previous conversations is that, like, whether you personally identify with something or your parents personally identify with something, that's valid for them. Like, they can choose how they want to see themselves and the context in which they live. But it doesn't mean that, like, these terms don't have a potential use. And something I really want to do with the show, with Asian Americana, is, like, if the term Asian American does not feel like it fits, instead of throwing that term out and being like, well, my mom doesn't think about it this way, so I'm just going to not use it because it's useless, why don't we expand that term to include all of our cultures and histories and include more of us so that your parents or you or whomever in your community can go, oh, maybe this is for me. Maybe I am included in this. Because much like those towns change, the term changes. I think the term changes and it can include new people that come over time, but only if we don't think of it as like some static label that no longer applies to us, but rather the term is like a town where by proxy of living there, we shape who it is. We shape what it means to be Asian American.
Totally. Yes. 100% agreed.
Earlier, I had asked Sarah what kind of stories she's interested in, but I also wanted to know, what kind of Asian American stories does she feel like we have too much of already?
Ooh, I love these provocative ones. Great question, too. I'm probably going to get some flack for this, but like I personally am sick of hearing the like hardworking immigrant story. Like, obviously, it's valid, but I think that that storyline gets flattened a lot. Especially maybe it goes hand in hand, the hardworking immigrant story and then subsequently the like generation that comes after that and kind of the like stereotype that comes out, which is that they're like fully American and they like assimilate and become a doctor or whatever, move away to the suburbs and are rich. I guess I'm sick of kind of hearing that trope over and over again. It's something that came up a lot in my coverage of Chinatowns and kind of those places. I tried not to highlight it too much in the way that we told our story about Chinatowns. But yeah, I think that's the one that media tends to, I mean, it's a winning story, right? Everyone loves a winning story, but it's overdone.
One of my personal answers to that question is related to that, is that I'm tired of success stories being like the only framing for us, but I feel like so much of Asian American media, including those made by other Asian Americans, are like, well, this person became the first, the best, the only one to do X and Y and Z, you know? And like, I am all for Asian American excellence. Like, that is cool. But it's also like, what are we saying when like those are the only stories we want to go to? Like, hey, this person's like an Olympic level athlete. Like, wow, awesome. I definitely can't do that. But also like, what happens to the number two person in that team? Or when they're like, oh, well, this Asian American built this huge restaurant empire out of nothing, or became this big tech mogul out of nothing. What happens when you're just running a mom and pop shop that's not the best restaurant on some top 50 list? Or, you know, what happens when you're just like, I just do the thing. I just live my life. And how do we do more stories about that and the interesting things there instead of being like, you're only worth covering if you're the best, the first, the only person to do a thing?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I have a friend who we joked that we should start a podcast called like Normie Asian Americans, where we just like talk about our kind of mediocre lives. So yeah, 100% on board with the second place Asian.
Finally, Sarah shared what she hopes listeners take away from Mid-Pacific.
I think that at the end of the day, Mid-Pacific is a very personal exploration of what being Asian American means to me and kind of like me looking for points of connection with other Asian Americans, of course. So I wouldn't want Mid-Pacific to feel like it was some like academic tome, like telling you exactly what to feel. I kind of did want it to just be a conversation starter. I guess I'd want people to hopefully come away being like, oh yeah, that's like something that sounds familiar to me, or I've also thought about that and I feel heard seeing it out there or hearing it out there and discussed by a couple different folks. But also like, I have thoughts and I guess I'd love for them to reach out and chat with me more about it. I love talking about this stuff.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Quincy.
Thanks to Sarah Mises-Tan for chatting with me and the entire Mid-Pacific team for sharing today's episode. Again, you can find them on your podcast apps or on their website, capradio.org/midpacific. Asian Americana is hosted and produced by me, Quincy Surasmith. Our opening song is We Belong by Magnetic North and Tayo Na, featuring Chris Ajima. The song you're hearing with these credits is We Are the Children by Chris Ajima, Nobuko Miyamoto, and Charlie Chin. You can visit our site at asianamericana.com, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter at @Asian_Americana. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. If you really like the show, you can donate by becoming a monthly supporter on Patreon. Just click the support button on our website. Asian Americana is a proud founding member of Potluck, a collective of podcasts featuring voices and stories from the Asian American community. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more stories of Asian Americana. Want to hear more? Check out this other show from the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hello, I'm Phil Yu, and I'm the host of All the Asians on Star Trek, the podcast in which I interview all the Asians on Star Trek. I'm talking to actors, writers, directors, stunt people, background extras. You know, all the Asians on Star Trek. Find out more at alltheasiansonstartrek.com. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Live long and prosper.